Good evening, everybody. You're tuned to 103.2 Dublin City FM, and this is Europe Today, with your presenters for this week, Ava Rutzel and myself, John Bourne. Coming up on the programme this week, Ava will be speaking to Gerard Gallagher from the Office of Evangelization and Ecumenism about the upcoming World Youth Day in Krakow, Poland. I'll be speaking to Louis Echeverry, the Director General of the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and the Development of the Nuclear Energy Agency. We'll have a rundown of some of the stories of European interest that are making the headlines here in Ireland. And we'll have some great music from France and Denmark for your enjoyment as well. So stay tuned to us here on 103.2 Dublin City FM for the next half an hour on your programme Europe Today. The EU Commission is advising the 50,000 or so Irish fans heading to the European Soccer Championships in France to carry a European Health Insurance card. The card entitles an Irish person or EU citizen to receive free or reduced cost medical cover in the event of an accident. It can be obtained by logging onto www.ehic.ie. Ruth DC of the EU Commission office in Dublin says the card brings many benefits if a medical emergency occurs in another European Union state.
Well, if you have the card, you're entitled to be treated in the French public health system the same as if you were a French person. So you are entitled to all the benefits of that system, and the Irish system reimburses France afterwards. But you should apply for the card before you go on ehic.ie.
The days of writing hate speech or lingering defamatory remarks on social media sites are coming to an end. The European Commission, Facebook, Twitter and Microsoft have agreed a code of conduct which aims to end online xenophobia and defamation. As part of the deal, IT companies will now monitor all online postings. Ruth DC of the EU Commission office in Dublin says where hate speech or libelous comments are written online, IT companies that are part of the deal will be obliged to remove them within 24 hours.
Well, it means the days when racist, xenophobic comment about individuals or groups was put on Facebook or Twitter or other places and just left there are coming to an end. It has to be taken down within 24 hours.
Now you can follow Europe Today on Twitter.
Hi, this is Eva Rützel for Europe Today on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Today I talk to Mr. Gerard Gallagher, the contact of the Office of Evangelization and Ecumenism, about the World Youth Day and about a travel from Dublin to Krakow, which is already planned for this year. It is a great chance for young people. Now Gerard will tell us a little bit more about that. Hi, Gerard.
Hello, how are you?
Fine. Would you please explain again what the World Youth Day is?
World Youth Day is an appointment that the Pope keeps with young people from around the world. It takes place every 2 or 3 years in a different country, and it travels around the world. For example, the previous one in 2013 was in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, and the one before that was in Madrid. So this year, everybody around the world, young people, are heading to Krakow in Poland for the last week in July with a meeting with Pope Francis.
And what is planned for this event for this year?
What happens is the young people attend different parts of Poland just before they arrive in Krakow. So they will go to some other cities or parts of Poland for a cultural experience where the local church and the parishes would welcome some of the young people. The young people from Ireland are mainly going direct to Krakow. What happens is they arrive in Krakow and there's a huge welcome ceremony in Bologna Park, which is in the city centre area. And then over the next 4 or 5 days, they estimate around 2 million young people will attend the event. Pope Francis will be there on the Thursday, I think it's the 26th or 27th of July. He welcomes the young people then to Krakow.
Okay, for how long will they travel?
They will travel mainly for about a week. Pope Francis will be there for 5 days.
Wow.
And his pilgrimage is also it's part of the Year of Mercy. So he is completing the visit of Pope John Paul, who was from Krakow and was Archbishop and Cardinal and visited Krakow as Pope. So he is going back to honour Pope John Paul, who is now sainted, Pope John Paul II, and to walk this pilgrim path of mercy. We are celebrating a year of mercy in the church. So one of the other saints at World Youth Day is Sister Faustina, who would be part, lived in Krakow. And this whole divine mercy, it's a form of prayer or spirituality, originated in Krakow. So the Year of Mercy will complete some of its program there.
How many people or children will travel to Krakow? Do you know that?
Around 1,500 young people from Ireland will attend. These are young people who are teenagers, so mainly 16, but a lot of them would be in their 20s as well. So we have a very large group from Dublin. We're the largest group from Ireland. We're around 300 people. And then from some other parts of Ireland, then they make up the rest of the numbers, bringing it up to about 1,500. We will be accompanied by some priests, and we will also be accompanied by our archbishops as well.
All right. For how long have you already planned these travels from Dublin?
So we've been planning for World Youth Day for about a year, promoting it in parishes and in different parts of the greater Dublin area. So parts of Wicklow, parts of Kildare, parts of Dublin as well. So we're very happy. We have trained our leaders. We have volunteer leaders who will, you know, take responsible roles at the event. And then our young people are now, some of them are doing exams in college or in leaving cert. And we'll meet them again on the 25th of June. And there's great excitement among these young people. Most haven't been to Poland, and the majority have never met the Pope. So they're very much excited, looking forward.
Okay, and do you only organize the travel or anything special there in Poland?
I know we are responsible for them whenever they travel. So we have organized their travel, their accommodation. And then we will have a program at World Youth Day. Each day there would be a certain number of events that everybody would attend. So we would be in charge of that. And then some of the events are together with all the pilgrims. So, for example, on the opening day, there might be a million people in Krakow for the opening event. The final event with Pope Francis, they estimate around 2 million people will attend. It's kind of near Krakow. It's about a 15-kilometer walk out of the city. So if you can imagine a small city, Krakow's not a very big city, so it will be a huge number of people that will be there. So the church in Poland will be a young church for that week. And the Polish people are very excited about welcoming these young people from around the world, many countries.
What kind of accommodation did you choose? How could you find such a big accommodation for people?
Well, usually the Krakow would provide accommodation, usually in parish halls or with families or in schools. Our accommodation will be in a university, so it's kind of, it's very simple accommodation. It's just beds and bedrooms, but usually at World Youth Day, young people don't even have beds. They just sleep on floors or they camp or whatever. So it's a pilgrimage. It's not a holiday, so there's no luxury.
Yes, that's true. Could you summarize again, why do you think that a World Youth Day is a great experience for young people?
I think young people love to meet other young people who celebrate their faith, their Catholic faith, in a positive way.
Yes.
It's not easy doing that in Ireland. However, you know, when they meet other young people from other parts of the world, where, you know, they could be from the Middle East or from parts of Africa or Latin America, they also see that other young people in other parts of the world have different challenges to keeping their faith or to celebrating their faith. So it expands their imagination of what it means to be a Catholic today in the world, not just in Dublin.
Yes.
And then secondly, it's an invitation and a challenge to do something more active about that at home in their parish. And so we're preparing young people to travel, but we're also preparing to welcome them home again and prepare new challenges for them.
Very nice. Where do we get more information? Do you have a website?
We do have a website. It's evangelization.ie. So that's evangelization.ie. And then we have a Facebook page and social media. It's called The Young Church. So if you go onto Facebook and put in The Young Church, you can kind of see what we're doing with our young people.
Okay, very good. Is there still the possibility to participate in an event this year?
There are a number of places still available. However, we have been sold out for a while. But if people do seriously want to consider going to World Youth Day, if they get in touch with us here, we can put them in touch with some of the groups that have capacity to bring people.
Okay, thank you very much for the interview.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining Europe today on 103.2 Dublin City FM.
Je suis le vampire de l'amour. Je dois embrasser tous les jours.
rester en vie chaque nuit. Je dois embrasser pour toujours. Oh vampire, vampire de l'amour. Chaque nuit sous ta peau mon ombre se petit se divise. Mon ombre je pars en confetti.
Vampire, vampire de l'amour. Vampire, vampire de l'amour. Chaque nuit sous ta peau mon ombre se petit se divise. Mon ombre je pars en confetti.
Broadcasting on 103.2. This is Dublin City FM.
Concern about global warming and renewable energy sources have steadily brought back the issue of nuclear energy and its feasibility to this ongoing debate. So to get some expertise for us here on Europe Today, we got in contact with Louis Echeverri, who is the Director General of the Nuclear Energy Agency in Paris. I began by asking Mr. Echeverri, how has the debate on climate change affected the attitude to nuclear energy in Europe?
Well, I think that is affecting a lot, you know, the perception that the society has about nuclear power. I think that everybody has realized how important it is to fight against climate change, and specifically that the solution is to reduce seriously the emissions of CO2. And most of the emissions, or a very important part of the emissions, comes from the use of energy, and in fact from the production of electricity. So I think that from that point of view, many people have realized that nuclear power has a very clear added value now against climate change.
Within the industry itself, has there been a perception that attitudes across Europe are changing? I know there's a bit of difficulty in Germany, but Angela Merkel now has a big meeting this week. But within the nuclear industry, is that perception changing, that it's becoming more favourable for countries to accept nuclear power?
Well, I think that the industry logically is very pleased with the change of attitude. But I think for the industry, it's really important what the politicians think, whether they take decisions. Because, you know, the social perception is at the base of the political decisions, but you need the political decisions. But in the last 2 or 3 years, there have been very important decisions in some countries which have opened the possibility for the industry to participate with new investments. And I think that not only Germany, which is debating, as you say, this week, whether they are going to extend the life of the nuclear power plants, you know, which were curtailed by the existing legislation. Also countries like Italy, for example, United Kingdom, Belgium, Sweden, you know, all these countries are considering, after many years of being very reluctant to make more investments, they are starting to think seriously in new investments.
Is it purely climate change, or is there maybe something else, maybe the war in Afghanistan and Iraq and the reliance on fossil fuel, do you think, or is it purely from a climate change point of view?
I think climate change is a very important driving force, but it's not the only one, as you say. I think there is another concern that many people has, which we could define as security of energy supply. And this implies to have access to enough sources of energy and also at reasonable prices. And I think that during the years in which there has been an escalation of the price of oil, people have been concerned because this was affecting the price of natural gas. And also when we have had very hard winters and there has been problem of supply of gas from Russia to Ukraine and some European countries, people have realized how important it is to have security of energy supply. So I think that in the case of nuclear, both elements are the ones driving politicians and the society to reconsider nuclear power.
Well, on the issue of security, I know you're talking about to secure the supply of energy, but on the issue of security, what steps are being taken now to ensure the safety of nuclear facilities and the safe disposal of MOX and nuclear waste?
Well, first, regarding the operation of the existing facilities, I have to say that there is more than 40 years of experience. There are more than 430 reactors operating continuously, 24 hours a day. More than 350 reactors are in the OECD countries. So I think that this means a very, very great experience. In addition to that, there is a lot of coordination between the industry. They created an association called WANO to have peer reviews of the facilities to make sure that, there is an international input to every single station. And also the regulators, through our organization, the Nuclear Energy Agency of the OECD, and through the IAEA in Vienna, they are continuously discussing how to improve nuclear safety. And I think that this binomium between a reasonable, responsible industry and independent regulators have made sure that there is a good framework to operate nuclear power plants.
Has technology changed in any way since Chernobyl? The Chernobyl is always trashed out when this debate comes on, and we all know that was just a whole sort of catastrophe that was. Could have been avoided. It could have been. There was no need for it. It was due to very lapsed security measures and things like this. But has technology changed in that time, or has the industry changed in any way that can guarantee people the security of a nuclear facility?
Yes, I think that Chernobyl has been a hard experience that everybody has learned from. Well, the first consideration is that the reactor, the design of that reactor, is not similar to the reactors that we have in the OECD countries
right.
And in other parts of the world. But in spite of that, there has been a very thorough analysis of the conditions leading to that accident, and I can say that many things have been improved from then. To give you some clear examples, this has reinforced the idea that we had in the OECD that containment buildings were fundamental for safety. Also that, to have operators which understand and have a very good knowledge of nuclear physics is also fundamental, so they can understand, how to operate better the stations and to have an appropriate training with simulators. But also other things like, not to rely only on operators, to have automatic systems, safety systems.
Yeah.
In order to shut down the plants every time that something, even minor thing, happens.
Right, yeah.
All these things have been implemented in all the reactors now.
Would you say, Mr. Echeverri, that the chance of something like Chernobyl happening again, we can never know, but the chance of that happening again is almost impossible. Would you say that?
Yes, I think that another Chernobyl is impossible. I think Chernobyl is not a reference any longer. What it is a reference is the accident in Three Mile Island. Accident in United States meant the total loss of the station, but it didn't have any impact outside because it has an appropriate containment building. I think this is impossible to say that this cannot happen again, but Three Mile Island is the reference accident, not Chernobyl.
Right, okay. Is there a particular country in Europe, from your point of view, that would be at the forefront of nuclear energy?
Yes, well, I think there are two countries at this moment which are at the forefront. One is France, which have the largest park of nuclear power plants, 58, producing more than 75% of the electricity, and they are exporting their technology, so this is clearly a leader. But from the point of view of investing in new nuclear, I think we have also to say that Finland is a leader in the sense that they are the first country, and you were referring to high-level waste, that they decided to build a deep geological repository for spent fuel before deciding to invest in a new nuclear power plant.
All right, fantastic, yeah. And as you say, I mean, the amount of the reactors that are in operation at the moment is phenomenal. I don't know whether this is true. Somebody told me that in France, you mentioned France earlier on, that what they've done is that they have standardized their model and every factory is almost identical. Is that a way forward?
Yes, I think this is very important because the cost of producing and constructing nuclear power plants is very sensitive to standardization. Once you standardize, you reduce significantly the cost. And this explains why the French nuclear program has been so successful.
Right. And of course, a lot of people will always use the Swedish and the Finland model for as their idea of an ideal society. So it must be fantastic for the nuclear industries to see nations like Finland embracing nuclear technology.
Well, yes, I think this is a demonstration that very, cultivated societies, very sophisticated societies with a very good protection of all the individuals in the society are developing nuclear power. So this means that, nuclear power is not against the society. It's just the opposite. I think the most, cultural advanced societies are going ahead with investments in nuclear power.
And just from our point of view, Mr. Echeverry, for Ireland's point of view, a lot of people would say it's too small, really, to have a nuclear reactor, nuclear facilities, nuclear power. What would you say to that? We are thinking of buying in an energy source from Britain, presumably. But what about us as a nation? Are we too small to have nuclear energy ourselves?
Well, I think that the important thing is not how small a country from the political point of view, but how small the electrical grid is. And in the case of Ireland, since Ireland has not very good connections outside, as you say, for example, with Britain, yes, the electrical grid in Ireland is at this moment very small as to introduce a nuclear power plant. The nuclear power plants which are in the market today, the only ones in the market today, unfortunately, are very big, between 1,200 megawatts and 1,600 megawatts. So you need a grid of at least in the order of 15,000 megawatts or 20,000 megawatts. And Ireland is very far from that. It's about one-third of that. So I think that with existing reactors, if Ireland wants nuclear power, the first thing would be to have a very good connection with Britain. This would allow to have a bigger electricity grid. It could be possible that in the future there will be some small reactors. Many industries are working on that. They are not in the marketplace today. But if this happens in a few years, I think that will be a tremendous opportunity for Ireland to start introducing nuclear power with small reactors.
Right. Well, of course, it all depends on the attitude. And as we say, the debate last week that we covered on the program was a school debate, and the winning team was a pro-nuclear team. So attitudes are changing across Europe. And as you say, as technology develops, it may not be, well, maybe not in our lifetime, but it's certainly, the way climate changes, is the attitudes are changing towards that as well. It's possibly inevitable that eventually we will have nuclear power here in Ireland.
Yes, many people think that way. As you have very well defined, in long term, I think that it will be difficult to conceive societies without nuclear power.
Final question. Do you think it's inevitable that everywhere is going to be eventually nuclear powered?
Well, I think that, that depends also in a specific situation in specific countries. I think, for example, to develop nuclear power, you have to have some kind of infrastructure. And this is going to be difficult in some areas of the world. But conceptually, yes, but in practical terms, some countries will have a long way to go before doing that.
Right, indeed. Okay, Mr. Echeverry, you've been very good to take the time to talk to me on Europe today, and I'm sorry we ran a little bit over your time there. So, muchas gracias, and I hope we can talk to you again at some stage.
Muchas gracias.
Well, I'm afraid that's all we have time for this week's folks. I hope you've enjoyed the programme. Again, we want to say a very, very special thank you to Gerard Gallagher and Louis Echeverry for joining us as our guests this week. Don't forget to check out our support website platform, which is europetoday.ie. That'll have a podcast of today's programme and links to the various items that we spoke about as well. I hope you'll join us again at the same time next week here on 103.2 Dublin City FM and your programme Europe Today.